From the University at Buffalo School of Social Work, welcome to the In Social Work podcast. I'm Peter Sabota. Thanks for joining us, and good as always to have you along, everybody. Lately, in fact, almost every day, we hear of a new and lightning-fast assault on the people, institutions, and values that are near and dear and even fundamental to the profession of social work. Many social workers and advocates of human rights and justice are wondering, how do we even talk about what's going on? What are the frameworks to understand what's happening, and what can we do about it beyond the performative? On today's show, we are joined by Dr. Rosemary, or Rosie Barbera. Dr. Barbera is a longtime human rights advocate, student and scholar of social movements, and an academic who brings an international perspective to her thinking and activism. She'll discuss where she thinks social work is and needs to be in our current climate, and talk about why it's important to look at and connect history to the present, and how these histories can be instructive in light of social movements and action in the US and other countries. She'll also spend some time describing the need to engage in political action, education about policy and political processes, and finally about moving human rights from theory to mobilization and action consistent with our values. Rosemary Barbera, PhD, is associate professor in the Department of Social Work at LaSalle University. Hi, Rosie. Welcome to In Social Work. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Peter. Good to see you. Good to be with you.
Yeah, you've already told me that it's beautiful in Philadelphia, and I'm not going to tell you what it's like here in beautiful. It's always sunny in Buffalo, is it, to coin a phrase, right? All right, well, yeah.
It's always sunny in Philly, is it?
I know, that's why I'm goofing around. I know, yeah. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us.
Sure.
So let's just get right to it, if you will.
All right.
So I think it's probably fair to say we're living in, you know, to say the least, interesting times.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. I know that we're, you know, we spoke previously about, you know, how do we mobilize our profession and ourselves, our students, into action? You would think that we would be good at that already, but obviously we're a work in progress. Every day we hear of, you know, regular and kind of lightning fast assaults on, you know, people, institutions, values that are, you know, dear and fundamental to our profession, as well as human rights and justice in general. So, and more than ever, you know, and we're both educators, I hear students, colleagues, and even like-minded, you know, lay folks wondering out loud about things like, you know, how do we even talk about what's going on with each other? You know, what are resources or frameworks to make sense of it all? And then finally, you know, the most practical, what can we do about it? Especially beyond the performative stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So that is, that's our mission for the podcast. You're going to solve it for us, which was very nice of you on this Friday afternoon. So that's where we're going to go. So when we look for ways and frameworks to mobilize social workers to action, where do we even start?
Yeah. So, you know, I think I kind of see this as like, you know, a thinking out loud kind of an experiment, not experiment, but, you know, exercise here. And so other people hopefully will, as they listen, have some ideas. But I think one of the things for me that's been really important is to look at history and, you know, and of course we know like history is being erased or trying to be erased, you know, recently with so many different directives and things going on at the National Museum of African American History, all of that kind of stuff. You know, we're not getting the full sense. And we've never really, I don't think, gotten the full history of what it is, what our country, the roots of our country. And we also don't know a heck of a lot about other countries as well. But I think the history that we really need to know is the history from below.
From below, you below.
Below, like the people who are not the people in power.
I see.
So, you know, and I think that's important for us to know in our own history in the United States as well as internationally. And knowing and understanding that the history we like and the history we may not like, you know, like, and I mean this particularly in social work, right? Owning up to our faults in social work that actually aren't just in the past, that we still kind of continue to use
Oh,
some
yeah.
theories that are the colonial mindset, right? That, you know, and practices and asking, you know, round people and small pegs, all of that kind of stuff. So I think about, in terms of the United States, I think about like the work of Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States. I think we can learn a lot from his work and others like him. The Zinn Education Project and Rethinking Schools have lots of different materials and really accessible history that we don't often learn. We know something about the Underground Railroad, but I'm not sure that we know enough about it as a social movement. And I would tie that to the sanctuary movement today with immigrants, both the sanctuary movement in the 80s and today, and there's you know a real common thread there. But you know what was going on and the power of those people and the courage that they had, and where did people get so much courage when the consequences could be death, right? I mean, really incredible to think about it. Early union organizing as well. I was just at a talk about early union organizing in Philadelphia starting in the late 1700s. Like, I didn't know that. I've lived in Philadelphia most of my life, except when I lived out of the country, and I didn't know about all this really interesting work going on that laid a great foundation for workers' rights and the like. Anti-lynching. We just Ida B. Wells and so many others, right? That we finally, what is a couple years ago, got an anti-lynching bill in the US Congress after all those years. These are all kind of like social movements and groups of people that are part of our history that we can gain strength from, and that I think we need to study and look at and think about and say, what can we learn from that and how can we use it today? And then something a little bit more recently, something called the solidarity economy, like looking at different ways to do economics. So cooperatives, whether that's worker-owned cooperatives or member-owned cooperatives, they push back against you know, oppressive capitalist system that is all about consumerism. So here in Philadelphia, for example, they don't call it a cooperative. It's like a tool sharing program, but these kinds of things. It's part of the solidarity economy, right? Where you pay a small fee and you're a member, and everyone doesn't need a chainsaw on your block, right? You can share that. There's a bike one as well, where you can go and use the tools to fix your bicycle. All of those kinds of things, like creating different ways to operate. And that also helps us build community, right? All of these things
Absolutely.
also are about building community, getting to know each other, you know, and sharing our stories with one another, right? Stories are so critically important. And I also think about like what we can learn, particularly from Latin America, because that's kind of where I've lived from outside the United States. And just like Zinn has a book about US history, Eduardo Galeano has a book called The Open Veins of Latin America, which tells history from the bottom up in Latin America. And so I think there's a lot to learn. But you know, kind of recently, if we look at human rights movements across the Americas, you know, despite you know horrific kinds of human rights violations of torture, disappearance, exile, political execution, people fought back, right? People fought back. They didn't You know, they didn't hesitate. Many people didn't hesitate. Some people did hesitate, you know, let's be honest, but many people did not hesitate to continue to go out there and to say, what's going on here, right? When I lived in Chile and Bolivia, but mostly I lived mostly in Chile, you know, I was part of a number of human rights organizations. We would go out in the street in one, for example, and go to places where there was torture going on. And we would say, you know, in Chile, there's torture, it happens here, and the media doesn't say anything about it. or I think about the family members of the disappeared who would chain themselves to a fence outside the presidential offices, knowing that they were going to be the next ones, right? To be
hit.
And so those kinds of things, like taking that strength, and these are all history of very common, ordinary people that, you know, have a lot to teach us about how we can push back about these assaults, as you said, these assaults that are happening in our country against people, against just our, you know, just who we are. And I think a lot of times social workers don't look at these histories and these social movements enough, because we're too navel gazing and we only look at the work.
Yeah.
And you know, we don't have to be the leaders of everything. We can be members and participants and get involved in these things and learn about them and see how we can connect to them, and we can connect what's there to the work that we do. So there's some of the things I think it's really important for us to think about. You know, social movements build power.
Yeah.
They build community. And we definitely need both community and a change in the balance of power, you know, in our country, not just at this historical moment, but, you know, I think it's a long time coming. And so that's a really important thing that I think we can think about. And if we don't connect to our history, then, as the saying goes, right, we just repeat it. And,
yeah,
you know, I'm not sure if we repeat it so much or it just continues, right, that the abuses and the assaults, you know, are, you know, keep going.
Yep. So, oh man, there were so many, I didn't want to interrupt you, but there were so many things that I was thinking about while you were talking. And I'm thinking about, you know, I think people are too cynical sometimes, and we fail to realize what's happened here in even just the United States. And so you've got, like, what, the civil rights movement, women's liberation, gay and lesbian liberation. You mentioned unions, disability rights. These have all, you know, that none of them are perfect, of course, but they have made a difference.
Yes.
And they're almost blueprints for what might, will it work in this day and age? That's a great question. Are there commonalities amongst those movements that made them successful? Could you, I know I kind of hit you with that one, just kind of, you know, the top of my head, but what do you think? Are there?
Yeah, I think some of the commonalities are people who understand that their lives are connected, right? And so, and people who care about other people, you know, people who have a real kind of empathy, or I would go beyond empathy to solidarity, and understand that kind of
concept. That's a great word. Yeah.
You know, that we are, you know, we're together, we're human beings together, and we're, you know, and there's other living beings as well. I mean, we haven't even, you know, gone into that whole thing in terms of the planet and climate and things like that. But I think there are some of the commonalities, that building communities where people can work together and feel supported by one another. And not just, and this is one of the things I think is really important, and not just in the work, but supported personally as well. Yeah. Right? It's not just all kind of instrumental towards, like, the goals of the movement, but just as human beings, right? That supporting people as human beings and caring for one another. I think that's, you know, there are things that are really important for us to keep in mind.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I think about, you know, I've been a practitioner, social worker, and an academic now for, I think, 40 years or something like that. And I kind of think back over, you know, I think it's fair to be critical about social work. We have been complicit in a lot of things we shouldn't be proud of. But I'm proud to be a social worker, and everything that I criticize is really, I would call it, a lover's quarrel. But it is interesting how, at least my take, it'd be interesting to hear what you say about this, is that, you know, at least in our graduate school, many of the MSWs come in really are, you know, aspiring to clinical careers and to work in those settings. And, you know, I get that. I mean, but, you know, you kind of hang around long enough and you realize at best that's not very efficient. And that large scale change is really kind of where the rubber meets the road. What have we kind of gotten wrong about that? Is that social work education, do you think? Are there things we could do better? You mentioned history. Most MSW programs teach the history and policy of social work, don't they? You would hope.
You would hope, but how much time do they? How much time?
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes the history is in the policy class and it's one semester.
Yeah.
It's been reduced, right? Like I know.
Okay. I'm very excited. We just split them here in Buffalo.
Oh,
We
excellent.
decided it wasn't enough, so we split them.
I'm so happy. Yeah, because when I got my master's, it was 2 semesters, and so we got a real sense of, you know, the history and then also what policy means, all of that. So that's really great to hear and very encouraging to hear. I think we got into this false fight about, you know, a micro macro macro micro divide kind of thing, not understanding the connections between the two and how they are so dependent on one another, really. You know, I always say to students, so you know, I teach community and policy, and that's where my practice areas are. But I always say, I can't do community work if I can't communicate with people. Like if I don't have good personal skills, communication skills, if I can't understand people, if we can't build rapport, right? Then you're not gonna be able to do any community work. Likewise, if you're doing kind of more one-on-one and clinical work without the larger context, then are we just helping people adapt to some dysfunction in society? So I used to be, there's an organization here in Philadelphia, Immigrant Rights Organization, that I was one of the founding board members of. And when I cycled off the board, I continued to participate there as an MSW supervisor. There were 2 staff people, neither one were social workers. So I would supervise students from Bryn Mawr and University of Pennsylvania that were doing internships. And sometimes they were second year students doing social and economic development or policy or community, but oftentimes they were first year students going into clinical work. And what they always said at the end of that year was they now had a community context for clinical work and felt much better prepared to connect people to resources in their community, not resources in terms of services, resources in terms of organizations and ways to change things that were impacting the quality of their lives.
Yeah,
And
that's the oh, I'm sorry, but that's the rub, right? Because we've separated them when they're really kind of entwined. They're it that's a false dichotomy in a lot of ways. Sorry for
No,
interrupting.
I agree, right? That they really are connected. Is it true that some people make better clinicians? Yes, of course. Like, no, I have no beef with that. And but you know, how can we, and I don't think we've looked enough about how we can collaborate together. Right? Rather than just saying, all right, these are 2 different ways of practice and you know, they don't meet. No, we have to think about, well, how can we collaborate with that? The folks in Boston, the Boston Liberation Help folks, have a great way to do that. And I really enjoy their work. And they use Paulo Freire's work, you know, and do clinical work in a community context, right? And so they're really kind of combining it and doing some really interesting things. But if we don't work across systems, we're just going to be spinning our wheels. We're just going to be, you know, it's we're just going to, you know, not be looking at what are some of the structural issues that are causing so many people to suffer so much?
Yeah, and it's really this is very timely because just recently, maybe 2 weeks ago, I teach like a foundational interventions class here at UB, and I asked it was in the context of an assignment, and I asked my students to wrestle with as like people who are becoming socialized and you know just went what is it called, cutting their teeth in the profession, I ask them to kind of be reflective and ask themselves, you know, are you working to provide services primarily, or are you working for social change? And I, you know, I gave them, you know, that wealth pyramid that shows how, you know, wealth is distributed, you know, all in the top, you know, the top people have all the net worth and what net wealth. And I asked them who they were in solidarity with. And they actually, I would say half of them, I love my students, but half of them struggled with like what solidarity meant. And so, yeah, I think a lot of people come in looking to provide services because that's it's necessary. I mean, I'm not criticizing it, but there's a never-ending supply if you don't change the environment and the context that promotes those folks coming into your office on a never-ending basis. And I think that's where social work is kind of complicit, I
Well,
think.
I had a student, right, at a different
Mm.
institution who was an advanced
See,
standing.
you're smart. You're talking about students at your previous. I was criticizing my current one, so you're
But I
smarter
mean,
than
I've
me.
had these students both, but one particular student at a previous institution who had gone somewhere else for their BSW and came into our advanced standing, and he and said to me, when I was a BSW student, I was taught that social justice meant more services. Now I understand that social justice means we don't need so many services. I said, yes,
Yeah. Oh, that's
you got it.
good. I'm going to
Like
use that
that,
one.
you understand that that's, yes. Are we going to need services? Of course, there'll always be hospice workers. There'll always be all sorts of things. But so much of what we're doing is just constantly putting out these fires that are caused by the systemic or structural issues, and we never really get to do the other get to the other stuff, right?
Yeah, I don't want to, I'm going to change gears slightly here, but I don't want you to get away from us without, because you're, I think, at least in my opinion, you're kind of unique in that you've spent a lot of time working internationally. And like you mentioned in Chile and also in Bolivia, if I remember our conversation. So, are the movements and the expression of social work similar, different, and if so, in what ways? What have their social movements been enacted similarly to the ones here in the States?
Well, if we think about social work, in Latin America is much more political than it is in the United States. And by what I mean by that is not party politics, but political in the sense of being much more invested in protest, much more pushing for policies, and more work at the community level, more understanding of economics. That's actually one of the reasons I wanted to go and get a PhD was I was meeting so many people in social work that didn't understand economics. And I'm like, well, and I mean like also educators. And I'm like, well, if we're not, they don't understand, then our students aren't going to understand either how that plays into everything that we do. So I think
Everything.
there's a much larger understanding and a real like partnership in being involved in social movements for, all different reasons. So in Chile, I mean, this is a while ago, but in Chile, after the coup in 1973, one of the first things that was done was closing the School of Social Work at the University of Chile.
And weren't social workers in Chile among the disappeared?
Oh yeah, there are actually the, if you go to the, here's some self-promotion. If you go to the Katherine Kendall Institute webpage, that's part of CSWE's webpage, there are these international social work leaders, and they're usually individuals, but I wrote a piece about the disappeared social workers in Chile there. And so the irony is that so there are now social work programs again in Chile, and one of the programs actually is in the building where the former School of Social Work for the University of Chile was. And they had a
Whoa.
ceremony a number of years ago for those disappeared social workers. And there's a plaque there for them, et cetera. But they were, you know, it was closed down and they were disappeared because social workers were seen as part of the problem. Because, I mean, we could do a parallel for today. And that is
Go.
Tom Homan saying, well, you know, immigrants, it's tough to catch immigrants because they know their rights and all these do-gooders are teaching people their rights. Yes.
Thank you.
And that's what, you know, the Pinochet regime was saying, like all these social workers are too involved in communities and helping them organize to get their needs met. You know, not providing services, but organizing to get their needs met. And I think that's something, and that's a different perspective, not organizing again for services, but organizing, you know, to go to the government and say, you know, we need sanitation, we need the school, we need all that kind of other kinds of things, using our good communication skills, our effective communication skills to help people. Because sometimes people are really intimidated by that. And I think that's a great use of our skills, you know, to help make sure people can get their voices heard.
Yeah, this is great to talk about this because I'm also thinking about that we're going to stick with I'm going to try and stick with Chile for a minute here, but speaking of like practical and powerful protests, you know, at the grassroots level, wasn't it in Chile where the women who had their spouses and family members disappeared would dance with the pictures of the men pasted and they would dance by themselves with the pictures of their disappeared on their on their chest, probably. I mean, that's the image I have. And that grew into a pretty powerful and influential movement, didn't it?
So oftentimes people get that confused with the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina, but it really, it was Chile. And Sting, you know, wrote a song about it. They Dance Alone. You should have been there.
Yes.
He sang it in the National Stadium, which had become a concentration camp. And there wasn't a dry eye. And it's so funny because I'm looking off to my left. I have this arpillera, which is an embroidery of the women dancing alone. That was a gift to me. So they have the little picture on, you know, on them dancing alone, but they're dancing what's called the Cueca Sola. So the Cueca is the national dance of Chile based on a dance between a rooster and a hen, right? Mm-hmm. It's very heterosexist, but you would dance it with your partner. And so they started dancing it alone as symbolically to show that their partner was not there. So I encourage people to look up the song They Dance Alone by Sting. And it's in English and Spanish. You can find that whole album that it's on, I think was in both, it was in English. And then there was another version that was in Spanish and Portuguese.
Yeah, this is all coming back to me now. Yeah, maybe that's where that's where it came from. I'm trying to think. Now, this is Sting from the Police, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's Sting.
I'm not good at pop culture. You're a lot better at it than me.
And, you know, Amnesty International had a bunch of human rights concerts, and they would bring the women from Chile to those concerts in other countries too. And Sting was one of the singers. Sting and all sorts of other really great people. And they would bring the women from Chile to dance alone.
Yeah. How powerful, though. Oh, at least the videos that I've seen. Yeah.
And well, I've worked with those women. I'm hopefully writing a book. you know, other things kind of get in the way, but I've interviewed a lot of those women to tell their stories as protagonists because we know a lot about their family members, which is fine, but we don't know so much about them.
Yeah,
they were amazing protagonists, right? And so they, in a very sexist country, they just took the bull by the horns and went with it.
Yeah, and how brave, because it's just on the fine line of being adversarial.
Yeah,
something that could get them into trouble.
Oh yeah,
but also, you're gonna arrest me for dancing?
Yeah,
it's perfect, powerful. There's a lesson there.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for indulging me. That went in an interesting direction. I like that. So how about we come back to the United States and actually let's get like super practical for just a second. Let's talk about social work education. So any social workers who are listening to this will probably know that the Council on Social Work Education and the EPAS, what does that stand for? Educational Policy and Accreditation.
Accreditation
Yeah,
standard.
thank you. You know, they have two competencies out of nine that go something like this: to advance human rights and social, racial, economic, and environmental justice. It's kind of a tall order. And then engage anti-racism, diversity, equity, inclusion in practice. So, you know, those are kind of things on paper, but man, those are relevant to address our current environment, let alone, you know, almost like the status quo here. But I also think, like we were saying before, that it's fair to say that, you know, the meat and potatoes of those two competencies are really not the jam of most social workers or even students. I mean, not all, that's not fair, but I think there's some truth in that. Could you just talk a little bit about the connections that you see between those competencies and what we're talking about here in general, and how they can be instructive as a framework for what's happening now, and really how can we mobilize, do stuff, actually make a difference? I'm sorry that's very convoluted, but my hunch is you know what I'm trying to say. I
Yeah,
hope.
and I think one of the things that I have found with those two competencies particularly is that they remain theoretical in people in a lot of programs, right?
Yeah, I think you
First of
said
all,
it
how
better
do
than I
you
did. Yeah.
advance human rights and social, racial, economic, and environmental in a one semester course, for example? Or how do you, or even in a two semester course? And how do you do that if your the organization where you're doing your practicum doesn't, understand that?
Yep.
So we learn about what that means, but are we really giving the tools for people to kind of do that work on the ground, to really, I mean, I think the word in that competency, advance, right? To advance, what is
Yeah,
it going to
I'm
take
looking it
for
up
us?
here. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so I think
Yes,
that means,
advance. You're right.
that
Yep.
means like how do we, what kind of assignments are we giving? Are we bringing people into our classes that can talk about their human rights work and give us suggestions about how maybe some of their experiences with social workers, good and or bad, and how they could be better? I think that kind of thing could be really helpful because there's so much we're doing in our curriculum, right? So sometimes it's tough, and but we can learn from other people who aren't necessarily social workers. And I think
Oh,
in terms of,
beautiful.
yeah, engaging in anti-racism, diversity, equity, inclusion in practice, I think so I was on one of the subcommittees of the task force that looked at these issues for the writing of the competencies. And it sounded really good as we were doing all this work, but we kept bringing up some of the things that were still in like competency one, which sound like gatekeeping, which is really
The
racist.
ethical stuff.
Right? And so how could you, on the one hand, talk about being anti-racist, but then still have programs have to report out on these gatekeeping kinds of things that are based in white supremacy, so
Wow.
I think we have to, think about that. But and again, I think the same here is for us to listen to the people who are most affected, to listen to the people whose lives have been dedicated to this and who, have some real important things for us to say. And not just today, but even again, this goes back to history, some of those historical figures. If we think about Ida B. Wells Barnett, who, was not really permitted to be a social worker. So, you know, or other people who weren't able to get into social work schools. Or we look at the settlement house movement that was pretty much all white. And so there was a separate Black settlement house movement. And these weren't necessarily trained, I'm putting air quotes along trained, right? Social workers, because they couldn't get into social work schools. So how do we think about, well, what are some of the legacies of that? How might we still see that in our practice and our education? And how can we push back against that? So are we looking at theories that individualize people and don't and individualize all people and don't understand that there are many cultures that are more collectivist? What are we looking at when we look at self-care and not communities of care, building communities of care? You know, instead of, you know, reducing things again to that individual level, which isn't really going to deal, once again, back to the structural issues that cause so much, you know, social workers to suffer, right? In this case, right? Not even the people we work with, but the social workers themselves. So, you know, I think we need to do a better job. And I think there are people out there putting together, you know, resource guides. I've been working with ACOSA, the Association for Community Organizing and Social Action. And we're working on, along with other organizations, putting together a new macro guide, right? So with, you know, activities and readings and things like that. And I think continuing to do that kind of work and share our resources can become really important to help us, you know, integrate into our curriculum and help integrate into the practice. So, you know, how can we help students integrate this into their practicum experiences, into their internships?
Yeah, man, this is raising. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, not just leave it as a, you know, an intellectual exercise, but really it's a practice issue.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm just having a lot of light bulbs while you're talking, because, you know, a lot of this really could happen, for example, if we're talking about social work education in the field practicum. But most, our field practicum is not associated with a stipend, you know, and we rely on our colleagues in the community to literally volunteer their expertise at their agency. And, you know, in many ways, there's very, very few good reasons to take on that challenge in a challenging environment to begin with. So I think we ask a lot of field education. And you're right, when it doesn't fit, how do we make it fit? So I think we need to look maybe at our own structures, our own business as usual ways of doing things, if we want to get greedier about the impact that we can have.
I ask students, you know, what does it say about us as social work programs in terms of economic justice that we're asking you to do all this work and there's no compensation for you? And, you know, and I think that's, I mean, I love the organization Payment for Placements and the work that they've been doing across the country to, you know, get some sort of compensation for social workers. In Pennsylvania, just last year, they started having money available. It's not enough, and they're not enough of them, stipends, but for students doing student teaching. And this year, there's also legislation to do the same for social workers.
Yeah.
Also, so, Representative Gwen Moore, who is from Milwaukee, just reintroduced the Earned Income Tax Credit, and it's the Worker Relief Act, and she calls it the Worker Act, and she wants to expand it so that low-income students will be eligible for an Earned Income Tax Credit, which could be like having, you know, that money for their practicum experience. You know, so looking at things like that, that's a great campaign to get our students in a policy class.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
what say again what that organization was that is advocating
payment for placements?
Payment for Placements. Okay.
So I think it may have started at the University of Georgia with MSW students. And then it's got like over 40 chapters across the country now, and they're organizing for some sort of payment. And I've been working with a group of people that were doing some research around, you know, the effects of not having a paid placement on people's well-being, overall well-being, physical, mental, economic, you know, et cetera. And we have, I don't know, 300 pages of qualitative data, you know, looking at, you know, how people answered some of these questions about, you know, the toll that it takes on them.
Absolutely. So it'd
Yeah.
be nice if we mobilized as social workers on our own behalf,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah. So, in actually, some of our students got to go for the Leap Day, the, you know, Legislative Advocacy Day here in Pennsylvania, went to Harrisburg and talked to their representatives for them to sign on to this bill in Pennsylvania to get these stipends available for social work students. So that was cool.
Nice.
They felt
Yeah, nice.
they were really pleased to be able to do that.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what you it's like if you give them, and I think this is true of many students, if you can provide them the opportunity or give
Yeah.
them a hint, they
Yeah.
will mobilize.
Yeah.
I think that's exciting. So all right, so now I'm gonna bet now see the exciting part to the less maybe optimistic part here. When it comes to understanding history and truly understanding like the person and environment, all the things that we've been talking about, social movements, large scale change. What do you think our biggest obstacles to action are? And what do we need to do to overcome them? I think this is what stu I mean, I hear students talking about this. In fact, the person who is helping us record today, or Ryan, is one of the people I know who's asking this question. What can we do to overcome them, these obstacles?
So I always say to students, one of the things that we have to do is be countercultural, because we live in a society that glorifies rugged individualism, right? And so, you know, we go back to the pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, and I tell them how that saying actually means something that's impossible to do. So we've taken a saying that was developed to communicate something that's impossible, and we've made it the metric we use.
The answer.
Yeah, right. And so think about how like screwed up that is. So, you know, let's think about, you know, how do we move out of that individualism and move into, and again, not that we don't have, you know, not that we don't have any of that, but that we also see ourselves as part of a larger community. So I think that focus on individualism is an obstacle. I think fear, and I think that's a valid obstacle. Especially right now, fear. I have to pay my bills. I have to pay off my student loans, right? So that's an obstacle too, how education, you know, the whole loan thing in education. So people don't want to push back. And I'm not judging anyone for that, because people need to do that. They need to
It's
care
fair.
for themselves. But also, to some extent, complacency. We're kind of comfortable.
Oh, it hurts.
I think we're kind of comfortable. I mean, I have, you know, times when I'm really comfortable too, and I, you know, prefer to be, you know, here rather than on the streets or at a meeting or something. But again, that's where kind of knowing that if we're building, you know, communities in our movements and things, then I'm participating in something not just for me, but also because I have a commitment to these other people, right? And we're in
Absolutely.
this together. So, I think they're really big obstacles to action. And I also think our political system, you know, Frances Moore LePay says democracy isn't something we have, it's something we do. But here, democracy is something we have. We elect and then we leave it to them. And we have to get beyond that. We have to understand that the election is one step. Now we have to hold people accountable. And, you know, so here in Philly, they do, it used to be Tuesdays with Toomey. That was our senators, federal senator,
Pat
right?
Toomey,
So now they're doing Mondays with McCormick. He's one of our senators, and they do Fridays with Fetterman. because he's our other senator. And so people protest outside their offices and just say, what are you doing to push back? What are you doing on these issues? How are you protecting your constituents, right? And so, you know, those kinds of things, I think, you know, can be really helpful. And if you can't go, maybe you can go to, because you have to work or whatever, maybe you can go to a sign making meeting and, you know, and help out that way, making a sign, or maybe, you know, you can do something else. So, you know, understanding that we can push back and we can hold our political leaders accountable, and we must hold them accountable. That's what democracy is.
But I've got to learn how to do cognitive behavioral therapy, Rosie.
Yes.
Oh no! Don't send the letters.
And there's
please.
And there's a role for that. You know, I mean, there is a role for that. I'm not saying we throw that out. But wouldn't it be better if, you know, some of the people that you're trying to you know do cognitive behavioral therapy with, if you understand the context that is causing them so much distress,
absolutely,
you might not need that tool.
That's right. That's yeah, right.
You can help them create those conditions where they empower themselves to be part of something bigger than themselves and push back.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to throw you a juicy one here. Ready? Better take a drink of water. Yeah. Is there a difference between radical social work and progressive social work?
Oh no. Yes. So this is, yeah. So, my colleague and friend, Mary Bricker Jenkins, and I, you know, wrote first she and Barbara Joseph, and then Barbara had died. And so then I took it up with her. We have the radical social work entry in the Encyclopedia of Social Work.
Yep.
And it used to be called progressive social work. And we pushed for it to become radical. And the reason is because, as Angela Davis and so many others say, you know, radical means to go to the roots. And I'm not sure that progressive goes to the roots. Yeah, it wants to do away with the injustices, but is it willing to look at how they're kind of embedded in our society and they're, you know, and that we might need to, I don't want to use the term destroy, that you know, but we might need to rearrange some things. We may need to reorder. We may need to get uncomfortable in order to, you know, in order to make the changes happen. So that's how I see radical. But radical can, you know, also has this meaning that could be, you know, misused in other
sure.
ways as well. So as
exactly.
being violent. And it doesn't, and I don't use the term radical in the sense of violence, although, you know, poverty is a horrible form of violence, right? So that's violent
trauma
in itself. Yeah. So fighting against it, you know, I'm not saying, you know, that we should be throwing Molotov cocktails and things like that, but I'm saying that we need to push back. And sometimes, you know, Mark Lamont Hill, I don't know if you know him, he teaches now, I think, NYU, but he's from Philadelphia. He has a bookstore here, right, very close by.
Mm-mm,
and
no.
After the George Floyd protests, he said, you know, you're all pissed at us because, you know, you want us to play nice, but, you know, we tried everything. We had protests, we had sit-ins, we ran marathons, we raised money, we held signs, and you didn't listen to us. So a target went on fire, and now you're listening to us.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's some truth in what he's saying, right? Nobody listened until we really pushed back, you know, and sometimes that's what it takes.
I do wonder what it's going to take for us to be in the streets today.
Well, there's a political scientist. Let me see if I can find her name, who says that we only need like 3.5% of the population to be in the streets to make it, to make a difference. So that's not huge, right?
And that's the lessons of all the movements, right? If
right.
you don't have financial capital,
yeah.
you bring to bear human capital.
Exactly.
And that's we can be pretty disruptive if we stop doing our jobs.
Yes. Yeah. Eric, I want to give this political scientist their due. Erica
Chenoweth. Oh, wait, say that again.
Erica Chenoweth.
Oh, yes.
Statistics
Go on.
suggested that about 3.5% of a country's population participating actively in nonviolent protest can bring about significant political change. That's 12 million people in our country. But it has to be well organized. So we have to organize. We have to understand that, right? So it has to be, and we have to do it in a sustained way. And we also
Follow
have to
up, absolutely.
understand that it's not just the protest that brings about change, it's also what we do afterwards, right? The protest brings us together, it energizes us, it shows our power in numbers, but then we have
Community,
to continue. It's not just protests, so.
Great. All right. Well, all right. So we're bumping up against our timeline here,
Yes.
but I want to get I really do. I'm not buttering you up because I've asked you on the podcast, but I really think you're a unique social worker and scholar. So in your study of history, anthropology, your scholarship, your teaching, what about all of that gives you hope?
So,
I'll just stop right there.
Kelly Hayes and Mariam Kaba wrote a book called Let This Radicalize You. And I use it in one of my classes, and they say hope and grief can coexist. And so we actually just 2 weeks ago talked about this in class. And people are like, I hadn't thought about that before, but yeah, because sometimes out of grief comes the hope, right? That there is a connection between them, and that, we can, through our grief, we can think of better times. So I think that's something that keeps me motivated. I also think about Rebecca Solnit's work, Hope in the Dark, right? I'm using that in a different class. And she says, hope is only a beginning. It's not a substitute for action, only a base for it. And so, what gives me hope and give me hope for a while are young people, actually, like young immigrants and young and other people as well. And looking at how, in the movements that they are leading, they're really making the connections between LGBTQI plus rights, between the rights of people of color, between immigrant rights, poverty. They're understanding that. And that gives me hope because, if we can open up ourselves, and again, I go back to, one of my heroes, Angela Davis, who talks about we have to let the young people lead, right? So here's this international icon, right? Saying we have to get the young people lead and we have to learn from them. And it's like, yes, we do. Like, we don't have the answers, but they know a lot, and they're trying to build a world where they want to live in, right? So I think that, seeing them, and then also looking at the practice of hope. Hope is a discipline. We must practice it, and have working with people and helping point out to them, again, going back to our beginning of talking about history, that these are people. In class a couple of weeks ago, I asked people, let's think about, like, groups of people who had no reason to hope and yet still kept at it. And so we talked about that, and I'm like, so what can we learn from that? So trying to get that message out, that there are so many people, we don't even know all of them, right? But that just kept pushing back despite, and we can take, so we can learn so much from them.
Yeah, wonderful. So today is we need to wrap up, but today is we're recording this conversation on April 25th.
Right.
And before we began, when we were just kind of getting situated before we started, this is in the Hope Department, by the way. We learned that the students, the international students whose visas had been basically revoked and they were told to leave the country, apparently the administration is backing off on that as of today. And the other hopeful thing that happened, I think it was yesterday, is that some of the administration's attacks on higher education's DEI initiatives is actually doing well in the courts. And there were, I believe, two decisions that were saying, oh no, you didn't. You need to slow down here. So, I know I didn't have anything to do with that, but I am hopeful that I will. And before we end up, is there anything that we left out, or that, or any way that you would just like to conclude our conversation?
I think, yeah, I want to suggest to people, think about, be really kind of intentional about what you're reading, where you're getting your news, and then also intentional about not letting it overwhelm you, right? And so maybe turning off, for a couple hours a day, your news things, right? Or only spending a certain amount of time each day looking at the news so it isn't overwhelming. And at the same time, like I'm, as I prepare this course I'm teaching on immigration, every week I give a rundown of what's happened in the last week, in immigration. And as I'm preparing the
Jeez.
last week, right? I mean, it's like I prepared it like on Friday night last week, and then by Saturday morning there were eight more things I had to handle.
Exactly. Yeah.
But this week I'm being intentional about kind of saying some of the good things. So I'm going to use what you just told me as well. So understanding that too, like looking and understanding, yes, not being Pollyanna-ish because that doesn't help any of us, but also seeing that there are people who are pushing back and there are judges who are, trying to hold the administration accountable. I think that that's really, really important. And then there's this kind of saying I thought that I think that's really power was has been really powerful to me, so I want to share this. It says, "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now, love mercy now, walk humbly now. You're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it." And I think that because sometimes we think it's just too much. It's Perkai Avad, I think this is the name. It's not like really clear. It's the way it's written. I think it's AVOT, but I think it's a really important thing for us to kind of keep in mind, right? That we might not see the fruits of our labor. The Nicaraguan poet Giacondabelli says, "A cause isn't lost just because you don't see its outcome in your lifetime." The same thing here. We can be part of something that's bigger than ourselves and have confidence in that.
And we support the people who will continue it,
Yes.
right?
Yeah.
Rosie, thank you so much for joining us. Very timely, very practical. Thank you very much.
Sure, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to Rosie Barbera for joining us. The In Social Work podcast team that mobilizes this show are Steve Sturman, our tech and web guru, Ryan Trofe, our GA production assistant, guest coordinator, and content curator. Say hi, Ryan.
Hello.
And I'm Peter Sabota. We'll see you next time, everybody.